is minus 12, but it's going to still feel like minus 20. So stay warm. It's going to be cold for the next few days.
Welcome to Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
This is Rob, cognitive psychologist, completely out of breath because I just ran here to get in right under the wire.
This is Daniel, your skeptical economics student.
Well, everybody, we have some really good news. Remember that fun drive we had a couple weeks ago?
How could we forget?
It turns out Radio Free Thinker brought in $598.80.
Woo! Well done, guys.
Go me.
So a few dollars short of $600. Hopefully next year we will triple that.
Yes. So who all was our donators?
Well, we had a lot of people donated, and I'd like to take this opportunity to thank everybody. I'd like to personally thank a few people who stand out. Paula, Scott, Gordon, Elon, Carrie, Fred, Louise, Ryan, Michael, myself, Marlene, Rob, and Eves. Everyone who donated, thank you so much. It was really appreciated. You've really helped us out. And I hope that those of you who got a prize pack, enjoy it.
And with any luck, in the new year, we might even be able to get a new hour-long show with this financial infus that we've done, because we did quite well, and it's all thanks to listeners like you that came in and supported our show. We really, really appreciate everyone who listens and takes the time to show that they care.
So if you'd like an hour-long show, please write into the station or radio.freethinker@gmail.com and tell us that you like listening to us for longer.
Exactly. And another way that our listeners can support us is by writing in and emailing us questions. And we happen to have such an email about our economics episode a couple of weeks ago. So, Daniel, why don't you take it from here?
A couple of weeks ago. It was like 2 months ago now.
Whatever. It doesn't matter.
We finally got around to answering this email by Alex. Basically, in that episode, at the end of it, I think we all gave suggestions for how to improve the economy, how to get us out of this recession. And mine was basically restored gold as the currency. And I really, and Alex really pointed this out, I should have been more specific. I should have said restored gold and get rid of fractional reserve banking, which is where when you put, say, $100 in a bank account, they only have to keep, say, $5 of it, and they can lend out the next $95 and so on through the banking system until your $100 really becomes $200, $300, $400. And this allows the total money supply in the system to really swell up and allows you to like do all these really bad loans and stuff that eventually brought our system down.
It's another way of getting virtual money, basically.
Yeah, it's instead of, say, a government having to actually just print out the money, it puts it sort of in the hands of private companies.
But that's also often known as money as debt. And although you use the gold standards, really, you don't necessarily have to have the gold standard to get rid of fractional things, as long as you have a fixed amount of currency in the economy and no fractional reserve.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be gold. It can be any commodity, really. Technically, it could be like just a government decree of like, here's all the cash in the system, it can't be any more.
But we all trust governments.
It could be whatever people make. I mean, there's a lot of different small communities like farming co-ops or small villages that have started printing their own internal currencies that are only usable by the people who reside in that area.
The biggest thing, though, is that there's a central or fixed amount of currency, and it's not everyone can make their own currency through debt.
Exactly. I mean, it's not that it can't expand at all. It's just that it expands in a predictable and generally small amount, and that's why gold is generally a good thing. He also brought up an argument that it's not so much these derivatives that are a problem, but sort of the lack of education that individual borrowers have, and I think Don is on the same
this. Yeah, well, if I understand what he's saying, there's two ways to look at this. So the first one is some people sit there and say, well, people got loans that they just couldn't pay back, and it's their fault for getting the loans that they can't pay back. But quite frankly, what happens is the person who lends the money is supposed to make sure the person they're lending to is capable of paying the money back, and it's the responsibility of the lender, not the lendee, to make sure it's right. So why would a lender make sure the lendee is valid? Why would I, if I'm going to lend you money, why would I make sure you're good? Because I'm expecting you to pay me back. But what derivatives do, and this is the second part of it, derivatives disconnect that line between person giving the money and person taking the money. Because I take the loan, and then I chop it up, and I sell parts of it to a whole bunch of other people, who in turn may chop it up to other people. So when you come to pay me the money for the loan, I no longer care whether you can pay me back or not, because I no longer have your loan. Someone who knows 5-6 layers away has parts of your loan. So when it comes time for me to give you a loan in the first place, I'm quite willing to you know, look the other way and do what they call ninja loans, which I wish I could remember the acronym for ninja right now.
Who cares?
Okay, anyhow.
Ninja loans. They sweep in from the darkness.
Exactly.
And give you some money.
People who lie on their loan applications, and the person, the loan officer, knows their line, but they don't look. You know, it's like, don't ask, don't tell. Because you're never going to pay him back the money. You're going to be paying some schmo who's in Wall Street who bought this derivative, or some pension fund who bought the derivative 10 times over. I think we mentioned last time in the show about a congresswoman in Ohio who is telling her citizens to say, listen, in order for someone to foreclose on your home, they have to present you your loan. So force them to present the loan. And a number of people have gotten out of foreclosure because no one knows who actually has the loan anymore.
Awesome. Sounds like a good way to screw with those evil banking conglomerates. I think I just remembered what NINJA stands for. It stands for, like, no income, no something asset. So it basically means like these people have no way of paying back these loans, and like the banks knew it, and many of them are like on record saying,
yeah, no income, no job,
no job. Okay, awesome. No jobs or assets. Okay,
right.
onto the
sounds like me.
Well, you know, the worst of it is, I mean, this is the evil side, right? I mean, if I was one of these ninja people, right? Oh, I'd love to go in there. If you're going to give me $200,000 or $300,000 and not worry about whether I could ever pay it back again, I could have one hell of a good time before you try and foreclose on me. And two, you know, a lot of people complain about the housing market, how it became a bubble. How did it become a bubble? Because people could get easy money because they didn't have to worry about whether you could pay it back. Buy houses, sell houses, buy houses for super exorbitant prices. So it all, one thing ties into the other.
Mm-hmm. Everything's connected in economies. He also pointed out wrongly that prices do fall over time, but this isn't true. Even though, like, most staunch defenders of this current system aren't going to tell you that, they have statistics that look at this, like the Consumer Price Index or the Producer Price Index, that show that in an average normal time, generally consumer prices are going up 2 to 3%, and producer prices are generally going up even higher than that. Even right now in a recession, when prices are most likely to fall, both of these numbers are still above zero in the U.S. and Canada at the very least. So even in these times where prices should be falling, prices are still rising. So anyone who's just holding on to that dollar, every like a dollar bill, every year they're losing on average about like 2% of what they can buy with that.
I also think that we should put the sources that you're using, getting this info from, up on our website. And also, if A is listening, then with your permission, we'll put up your email and also maybe some of your sources, and people can look on our website and compare them.
Yeah, I did, I think about a month ago, post a blog entry on our website, or at least it goes through our website, so you can see it there, that has most of what I've been saying here. If I notice anything else not on here, I'll make sure to add it.
I think one of the things that becomes a little confusing is there's a difference between how much stuff you have and how much value you have. I mean, one of the things since about the 70s or whatever, when they freed up currency evaluations, or who knows what the reason was, but anyhow, in about the 70s, the purchase power of a family has been steadily decreased. I mean, let's remember, in the 60s, right, you had one person working in a family and paid for everyone. And you had two, three kids, you had a wife and all that, right? And today, you know, you need two parents working, sometimes working more than one job. You know, the actual purchasing power of the family has been decreasing over time. That's part of the reason why debt has become more and more of an issue, is because in order to keep the system going, you know, it's progress, right? Every year you got to produce more, you got to sell more, it's got to be more and more and more. That's how the system works.
And the simplest way to see how crazy this has been is the U.S. dollar used to be pegged to gold at $35 an ounce, I believe it was, in 1970 when they finally released it. It is now trading at closer to $1,200 per ounce, which just goes to show you just how devalued the U.S. dollar has become compared to gold.
There's actually a book that was recently published, I think, I'm not sure about this, but maybe by Douglas Rushkoff. Someone should check me on that. But it's called Life Inc., as in Life Incorporated, and it talks about how the system came to be and how people have basically been stuck in this trap of debt and reduced purchasing power, and conversely, corporate thinking and profiteering.
Excellent. Well, that's not actually excellent. That's probably sad.
Well, the book is really excellent. And actually, I think parts of it were being serialized for free on Boing Boing.
Oh, well, there you go. That's pretty good. Well, that's great, Daniel. Thanks for coming up with some great answers that I don't understand. If any of our listeners want to email us about anything economics or
explain,
for example,
what it means to Ethan.
Yeah, or you could ask me about history things. please do. radio.freethinker@gmail.com. Let's go to a commercial break and we'll be back with more.
Shut up and listen to me right now. This is Fred Schneider, and you're listening to CITR. Shut up and listen to this radio station.
And welcome back to Radio Free Thinker. Well, if you heard the opening song, Girl, You Have No Faith in Medicine, it'll make sense right now. We're going to be talking a bit about Sonia McLeod.
Everyone's favorite homeopath and local.
How do we know her again? Because we've mentioned her before on the show, haven't
oh,
we?
Oh, yes, we have. She's a practicing homeopath who has written two articles for the Georgia Strait. Everybody knows that's my favorite newspaper.
In which she also advertises, and also some people say she is related to the editor, I believe?
On relatively good authority, not absolute, so I'm not going to say with certainty, but From the grapevine, she is the daughter of the paper's owner. And also on that same grapevine, maybe some of the other, quote-unquote, journalists at the Georgia Strait are a little bit intimidated to write pieces about criticizing Sonia's lack of scientific understanding in her articles.
I think it's quite interesting. You said she's a practicing homeopath, sort of like a practicing Catholic. Is that sort of a faith in that?
You might say it's
clearly
it's
she
faith-based.
Needs more practice. Anyways, what's she done now?
Well, you guys remember a couple of weeks ago we were talking about the H1N1 vaccine, and I think we mentioned how there is a background noise of sort of accidental miscarriages that happen just happen as a result of biology or...
There was a report in London, I believe, somewhere in the UK, probably London, that someone took the N1H1 vaccine and then there was a miscarriage and people thought that they were related, but when it turned out later to not be related at all.
Well, and let's not use the loaded term, because miscarriage sounds... There was a number of people who got the H1N1 vaccine and had car crashes. There were a number of people who got the H1N1 vaccine and won lotteries. Yeah. Right? So when you say background noise, you're just saying shit
people
happens
who
to
have,
people.
Have miscarriages regardless of what, you know, they happen to take. We even mentioned on the show, anti-vaxxers are going to use this as an example of why vaccines are bad. And that's exactly what Sonia McLeod has done on her webpage. Now, some prominent Vancouver skeptics actually caught her at this and started commenting on her blog, which she promptly deleted their comments. So a couple sneaky skeptics...
Really transparent.
used a different tactic. They were very polite. They were very non-confrontational. Basically just asking questions. And I looked at these posts. They were very innocent. I would even say that they were almost apologetic in asking questions. Very, very gracious on their part. So Sonia sort of indulged them with some really sort of token responses. Eventually she caught on to it and she wrote this. It has come to my attention that and bleh, are both members of a group called the Skeptic Society. The skeptics have a political agenda. They are anti-environmental and oppose all restrictions on business, especially biotechnology. They are avid supporters of big pharma, and they are also men. Oh, and I believe that they are addressing me and belittling this blog post in a sexist manner. Instead of listening to what me and these women have to say, they belittle our experiences and tell us that we are wrong. Well, I have one thing to tell you. Our experiences are more real and true than any of your sexism and put-downs.
It's quite funny that she uses an ad hominem attack to call him an ad hominem attack. I mean...
Yeah.
I mean, yes.
Well, first of all, I mean, we are not opposed to all restrictions on business. If anything, we're in favor of restrictions on business. I'm sure Daniel...
Well, yeah, no. How many times people have heard me sit there and say, we need more regulation, we need more of this? I mean, hell, I'm the communist here, right? I'm not going to say... I'm not in favor of big pharma. I'm not in favor of, you know, I mean... So, and didn't we do a show about global climate warming and all that? And,
yeah.
And genetically modified food. So, I mean, you know...
The sad thing is...
technically true that none of us are women... I seem to recall that about a quarter of the people who regularly show up to skeptics in the pub here in Vancouver are women, and there is a whole website dedicated to women in skepticism called Skeptic.
Yeah, if you've ever heard of Rebecca Watson, we had her on this show. She's one of the most, a lot of
she's
vocal,
very vocal
support. Yes.
If that was a phone-in interview, so maybe she wasn't really a woman.
Well, I'm pretty sure that when we had Jennifer Cabin on the show, she was a woman. There's plenty of females in the skeptical movement.
And either way, that's irrelevant. I mean,
it
even,
really
even
is.
Let's pretend that
well,
we
the,
were.
The point that I'm making here is that all of the things that Sonia brings up in this are basically, as you said, ad hominem and have nothing to do with answering the claims we were making.
Exactly.
She was dodging every question posed to her. And you know, my take on this, you know, aside from the fact that we know that the H1N1 is not causing abortions, that it's not causing miscarriages, and that, like Don said, you know, you could say that eating a banana will cause, a premature miscarriage, right?
And she mentions too about a political agenda. What does Sonia do for a living again?
She sells homeopathic remedies in a newspaper
so
that she advocates is better than Western medicine. That is a major conflict of interest. She is making profit off of making a fax.
Whereas even within the context of us four, we have differing political ideologies.
Exactly.
And we don't make any money doing this.
No, we're not in the pocket of anything. If we were in the pocket of Big Pharma, I would drive a cooler car.
Not yet, though, of course.
If any big pharmaceutical companies are listening, we are willing to take sponsorship.
We do like cars.
Yes, cars are fun.
Electric cars, of course.
Yeah, well, I want a Hummer. But anyway, so my personal, I would like to make this... to state that I think Sonia McLeod is dangerous. I think that she is, she's either, I can't imagine she's unaware of the conflict of interest she's presenting. I think that she just doesn't care, honestly.
Oh, you never know. Some people, you know,
if she's deluded herself into thinking that she has the answer.
She's clearly a nutter.
Yeah. I don't know her motives, but she is promoting something that is dangerous.
Deadly dangerous.
Deadly dangerous. Homeopathy alone probably won't kill you. But if you tell somebody not to get a vaccine or tell people that your doctor is a quack or that drugs are dangerous, not like prescription drugs, I mean, they can be dangerous if you overdose. But if you tell them that, you know, your pharmacist is trying to kill you, that's dangerous and that could get someone killed. And it's a public menace.
It's, and, you know, she can't even claim, I don't think, that she doesn't know this. Because, as you pointed out, people have posted to her blogs. There's been more than enough. She reads the newspapers, I'm assuming, at least to know the false facts.
So, I mean, think so.
This has been brought up enough times, right? I'm sure if she was listening right now to our show, she would find out this. In fact, I hope she is listening to our show.
I would be glad if she came on this show to defend her views. I think it'd be very interesting to hear what she has to say about this.
I would make it stronger. I challenge her. I'd say, listen, Sonia, put your money where your mouth is. Come on our show and trying to defend the facts of your case.
Yes, literally put your money where your mouth is, because that's what she's been doing on the Georgia Strait. Well, my advice to skeptics in Vancouver and across Canada and across the world is to keep talking about Sonia, because the more light we can shine on this person...
Not just Sonia, people like her. There's plenty of people.
Con artists in general. Don't ignore them. Don't go out there and debate them, but come out and say what they're doing is wrong. They are taking advantage of desperate people. It's terribly dangerous. It's wrong. And I hope skeptics will continue to do the excellent job they've done in promoting, you know, critical thinking and skepticism in the face of this pseudo-journalism.
You know, there's even a legal thing for this, right? I mean, if you willfully kill someone, it's murder. If you do something that causes someone's death, it's called homicide.
Yeah.
Manslaughter.
Negligent homicide, even.
Exactly.
Actually, I believe some people were convicted of that in Australia recently for giving their kids naturopathic medicine.
Yeah, that was a very famous case about a child who had eczema. Very curable disease, which they chose to treat with homeopathic remedies, ultimately resulting in what I can only imagine is a horrible, horrible death for that infant. And I believe the father got jail time. I'm not sure about the mother, but...
And there have been a number of cases in the States that we talked about that I think is no different, who use faith healing. You know, they prayed over someone who had, sugar disease.
Diabetes.
They had diabetes.
Yeah,
and they prayed over them to cure them, and the child died. I mean, there is no difference qualitatively between these two groups.
No, there really isn't.
There was a movement or some letter-writing campaign to the Georgia Strait.
Yeah, that took place after the initial articles by Sonia, and then a following article by another Georgia Strait writer who basically... clearly showed they had absolutely no concept of how science even worked. A letter-writing campaign, we initially wrote to the BC Press Council and then found out that the Georgia Strait is not a member of the BC Press Council. So they operate with basically no regulation whatsoever. So we sent letters to their advertisers. And I don't know what the response was for everybody else. My response was that they basically don't care, which should tell you something about people who advertise in the Georgia Strait. Maybe if we make enough noise about this, they'll change their minds, and let's hope they do.
Well, it's not just us making noise about it. When we come back after the station ID, I have a report on some researchers calling for more skepticism in scientific journalism.
Excellent. So stay tuned for that.
Want to know what's going on around town? LiveMusicVancouver.com is the Lower Mainland's comprehensive source for live music listings. We've got more than 350 shows listed at any time, and our listings are updated continuously by hundreds of the very people who put on the shows you love. Artist information and MP3s are accessible right from the listings, as are maps and calendars for virtually every venue in the city. All this and tons more totally free at LiveMusicVancouver.com.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
So aside from the topic of perennial interest to this show, naturopathy, local, you know, quack medicine, we also talk a lot about scientific journalism and how it seems to be not very skeptical, as in the obvious case of the Georgia Strait, but other papers in Vancouver. Recently, a trio of researchers wrote an editorial in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute that calls for more scientific skepticism in the media. They discuss recent media coverage of a couple of studies from the New England Journal of Medicine and the Journal of the National Cancer Institute to sort of show how the media doesn't really know how to skeptically report studies and how to present the data in a way that doesn't exaggerate its claims. So, for example, there was one headline that was reporting on the trial results of olaparib, which is a very hyped anti-cancer drug that's just basically starting its trials. And the headline was, "The Most Important Cancer Breakthrough of the Decade." Now, what the trio scientists in the article say is they look at the article and compare it to the actual study, and they see that the study was uncontrolled It was reporting preliminary trial results, and there is absolutely no guarantee whatsoever that this will in any way translate to long-term effects or even to larger sample sizes. So there's this sort of endemic problem in science journalism, which I think we had Jennifer on the show a couple weeks ago, and she was talking about similar ideas, that scientific journalists need to have a better idea of how to be skeptical and how to report studies accurately. You were going to say something?
Well, I was just going to say that I think that part of the problem is we don't really have science journalists. We have journalists who report on science. We need journalists who have a science background, because they would understand those terms that you just mentioned, like controls and laboratory conditions and peer review, right? I mean, the average journalist probably doesn't even know what those mean.
Well, and that becomes even more complex when you think about, one, is there's a shrinking of actual journalism in the world because of amalgamations of company media concentrations. You know, instead of having, Vancouver is one of the highest concentrations of media ownership. So why would Canwest, let's say, have five science journalists when one guy, who might even be from Ottawa, can cover the whole thing? And then you get that, because there's a lack of coverage, is a lot of the science articles actually don't come from journalists. They come from PR companies who send them out to these TV shows, radio shows, newspapers, or whatever, and they just filter them very loosely and say, okay, there's the article.
They trump up the results, make it sound good, then they get free coverage from the press.
So what else is some of the problems we have between the science article and the science reporting?
Well, here is another example that they give. The headline was, "A drink a day raises women's risk of cancer." Well, they look at the article and study, and they see that the article didn't mention anything about the magnitude of the risk. So they look at the study, and it compares the highest amount of drinking they measured, which is greater than 15 drinks per week, to approximately 1 or 2 drinks per week. And they found a 0.6% absolute increase in risk. That, for if you continue drinking at the same rate for over 7 years, that increases your risk of getting cancer by about 2 to 2.6%. So the magnitude isn't actually that great. But the headline, you know, "A drink a day raises women's risk of cancer." Well, the question here is how much? So it's another thing that, and you were saying before that science journalists aren't really scientists. They're not trained to think in these kinds of ways. So these researchers provide tip sheets for journalists. They include things like questions to ask study authors, interpretations of common stats, how to highlight study limitations in a careful and easily understood way in your article. Lots of really useful tips for how to communicate the study in such a way that it's accurate but still interesting to read.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting too, I blog with, you know, Skeptic North on my own. I'm not a scientist, though. You know, I don't have any training writing science blogs, so it makes sense to make this information available to everybody. I mean, you know, we all read, you know, like Phil Plait's blog and Stephen Novella's blog, but they're scientists. They know how to report a good, you know, science article and translate it so it's easily understood, and they're not, you know, sensationalizing it.
I'll post a link to this article and to the tip sheets that they provide on the blog.
And actually, I think linkage is good, because I was just listening the other day to NPR, and they had a thing about how heavy coffee drinkers have a significant reduction of aggressive prostate cancer. So they say if you drink more than 6 cups a day, you have a 60% less chance, and then that's all it says. And then I'm going, you know, what else is there? I mean, with 60% chance, does that mean it goes from 1 in a million to 2 in a million? Or, you know, what does all that mean? And they provided actually a link to the original article on their website. So you could go and you could check it. And, you know, it works out that there's like a 1 in 10 chance of getting prostate cancer, the study group. And this does reduce it significantly. Of course, they also say they have no idea why. So, you know, don't go out and drink coffee. They say don't go out and rush out and drink coffee. The article didn't say that. The article stopped short of that. It was interesting. But the actual report itself says don't go out and start drinking coffee, because they have no idea how it works. They think it's something to do with metabolism. But that's just the thing. You know, if you find an article, are there links to the original source? Could you follow up more information if you wanted it?
I was actually really impressed with I went looking for local articles, and I found a couple of bad ones that I don't really have time to talk to about how bad they are. But there was one in the Vancouver Sun that actually pretty much impressed me on these regards. The headline was still kind of bad. "Fat intake has little bearing on weight gain." So you sort of assume, okay, well, what does this mean? You look into it, and they found that the percentage of calories that a person gets from fat is less than from protein or carbohydrates. So given, you know, all things being equal, the amount of calories that you're gaining from the fat intake you're getting is negligible compared to the caloric intake you're getting from equal amounts of protein or carbohydrates. So the article actually had it received, they got an email from the study writer, the study author, and quoted them in the article. They didn't just sort of try and paraphrase what they read in the study, which was already paraphrased from the actual research. And they also mentioned in there that total caloric intake and exercise matter more than focusing on fat intake alone. And the thing that really impressed me was that they put the source of the actual study article right at the end of the article, so wow, everyone could find it.
You know, and that's the thing, too. I mean, with more and more journalism going online, I mean, no longer do you have to worry about, you know, space on the paper. It doesn't cost you any extra money to put in a little URL link to this or to that, you know. So, I mean, one of the great things about the internet is the dodges that they used to use aren't there anymore.
Because, well, people will find them out very quickly and call you out on them.
Yeah. And it goes to what we were kind of been talking about, is sort of upping the science literacy of the population. And if they have accurate science reporting, you know, maybe someone like Sonia McLeod will have a harder time promoting pseudoscience.
Well, part of it is a sort of basic understanding of statistics and probability is pretty much lacking. So there was a really cool TED Talk recently. Benjamin Arthur, you've probably seen his Math and Magic video, but he has another one where he sort of calls for the change in the math curriculum in North America to stop treating calculus as the be-all and end-all of math education and switch it to having people understand probability and statistics.
You know, and that's the thing. I mean, that's the big thing we do. I mean, people who listen to our show, you don't have to believe us, right? We're opening up questions. Go out and find out the research itself. On that note, I'm actually going to put another priming the pump. In January, we hope to do two specialized shows, one on the Vancouver Olympics and the other on the quote-unquote police state Vancouver has become because of that. So if you have any opinions or any ideas about that, please send us your ideas, email them in, send them to the blog, what have you. What was the email address again for our...
radio.freethinker@gmail.com. Well, we're really right out of time, so I just kind of want to quickly get in that Skeptics in the Pub, on January the 12th, is the first Skeptics in the Pub of the new year at 7:30. It's a special one, special trivia contest.
Oh, sweet, a pub quiz.
Exactly. You arrive or you form teams of four, and there happens to be four of us here, and Skeptics in Vancouver will be competing with Skeptics from Edmonton.
Topics so come and try and beat the Radio Freethinker pub quiz team.
Exactly.
Never.
So please show up, and you can get the Facebook link on our webpage. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying goodnight.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob, cognitive psychologist, saying you should check out the video of the coconut octopus. Just Google it on YouTube. You'll find it.
This is Daniel saying you should look at that video, too. It's actually pretty sweet.
Bye, everybody.
Have a good night.
The AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the helpline is one of many programs from AIDS Vancouver.